Welcome. I am Malihe Razazan, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today is our weekly media roundtable, where we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. 50 years ago this week, President Lyndon Johnson declared an, quote, unconditional war on poverty in America, end of quote, ushering in new programs such as Social Security, Medicare, and Head Start, among others. But after 5 decades, these programs are under withering attack and millions of Americans still live in poverty. So how are the media framing the poor? According to the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism, indexed stories in 52 major mainstream news outlets from 2007 through the first half of 2012, poverty affects nearly 50 million Americans, yet coverage related to poverty adds up to less than 1% of all American news. What are the reasons for this lack of coverage? Sasha Abramsky has been writing about poverty for many years. His latest book, The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives, is the result of his interviews with people that live in poverty. Some of his interviews for this project are archived at voicesofpoverty.org. Sasha Abramsky is a freelance journalist, writer, and a senior fellow at the Demos think tank, and he joins us on the phone from Davis. Great to have you back, Sasha.
Thanks for having me on.
And we are also joined by Greg Kaufman, the former poverty correspondent for The Nation and a contributor to BillMoyers.com. Through his writing and his weekly blog, This Week in Poverty, which ran on The Nation's website for 2 years, he has attempted to increase media coverage of poverty. And it's great to have you back on the show, Greg. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
It's really very exciting to have the both of you on the show today to talk about this important topic. And as the third anniversary of the Egyptian uprising approaches, there is very little room for celebration as the country experiences its harshest political crackdown in decades. To get a sense of what is happening in Egypt, we are joined from Ottawa, Canada, by Adel Eskandar, Arab media scholar at Georgetown University and the author of Egypt in Flux, Essays on an Unfinished Revolution, as well as the co-editor of Jadalia Izin. Welcome, Adel.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. And you're not on a cell phone this time, which
no,
is a relief, so we can hear you. Good to have you. So as we do always on Fridays, we start off by giving kudos to a journalist who did a good job this week. And let's start off with you, Greg. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I love the story from Bryce Covert over at Think Progress. Bryce is really one of my favorite poverty journalists. She wrote about a mother of three who's married. She owns a home. She has a master's degree, and she's a supervisor at a community action agency. She's up in Barnesville, Minnesota. But when this woman, Rebecca Johnson is her name, when she was 20, her first husband left her and her then one-year-old boy, I believe. And Bryce writes about, through Rebecca's story, Rebecca talks about how she really relied on Head Start for child care, Pell Grants to get her bachelor's, and then I don't know if she needed the Pell Grants for her master's, but certainly her bachelor's. They needed food stamps, they needed Medicaid. And so Bryce, what she's done is she's used a personal story, an authentic voice of somebody who lived in poverty, to explore programs that are vital for so many Americans. And then she sort of steps back and looks at the macro picture of how these programs are under attack at this time. And so that's really exactly what I was looking for journalists to do with this War on Poverty anniversary.
And Sasha, this is an issue that you focus on in your book and also in writing. And related to this, I really want to give kudos to NPR, Pam Fessler, who did a story called Kentucky County that gave War on Poverty a Face Still Struggles. And I think it was along the same lines, giving faces and voices to people who are going through poverty. So Sasha, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I actually was tremendously encouraged because you mentioned earlier that almost no attention has been paid to poverty by the media over the last few years. And suddenly around this anniversary, everybody was talking about it. Everybody was talking about the crisis of poverty, the crisis of inequality. And in a sense, we had so much to choose from that it became sort of overwhelming. I actually thought Al Jazeera did a very good job with some of their timelines around poverty. Tammy Kim's work on creating a timeline around poverty for Al Jazeera I thought was very effective. The other thing I did, I had put aside the New York Times series on homelessness in New York, and they'd obviously written that more than a week ago, but it was a long five-part series, and I hadn't had time to read it, so I finally sort of really got into that, and I thought that Andrea Elliott did an absolutely fantastic job of exploring what it means both to be homeless in New York and also what it means to live amidst affluence when you're in poverty. So I think those would be my call-outs at the moment.
So when you talk about Al Jazeera, unfortunately, a lot of people in this country cannot watch Al Jazeera.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the strange things that it's actually one of the great growing media projects. They're hiring a lot of very talented staff, but their access within the United States is a bit spotty. And it's strange, but, you know, they actually do some very, very interesting work at the moment.
So, and that's Sasha Abramsky. And I want to ask you, Adil, since before getting your kudos of the week, since you have covered, you've written about, and you follow Al Jazeera very, very closely, what is the state of Al Jazeera America at the moment?
Well, I mean, it's in a very interesting and very precarious situation. I mean, it's the first major startup, internationally based startup in the United States that focuses, on presenting news from the other side. It's going into a fairly competitive field to begin with and has a particular brand that is stigmatized within the United States. I mean, it's a difficult brand to sell in the U.S. because of the associations with the Arabic station. And it also is happening at a time when the Arabic language station is becoming the target of attack in the Arab world for being too Islamist and too supportive of the Muslim Brotherhood and things of that sort. So you've got all of that as a background or as a context. But even here in the United States, I mean, in addition to the lack of access in some areas, of course, there are some positive stories in the sense that I think it was Time Warner decided to embrace them. A few other cable networks have increased their visibility, so they should be available in at least 40 to 50 million homes now. But the ratings are still quite abysmal. And the question is it a matter of time before they are able to make a mark, or is the brand itself problematic? I think they're doing a fairly good job with a lot of stories, but it doesn't seem to be resonating. And the question is, are people migrating away from cable and towards sort of internet and online-based news? Are they joining the bandwagon at a time when the bandwagon is no longer the means of transportation? So there may be a little bit of a technological dissonance going on here. But I think they're fast learners, and they may find a way around it. But so far, it's been a very very slow few months for Al Jazeera America in the U.S.
So let's, before just going and diving into talking about Egypt, let's get your good story of the week and what you saw this week that really impressed you.
Well, to be honest with you, there's a lot of really good stuff on Egypt, but there's one thing that I think very few news organizations have actually done well, which is basically to talk about the Egyptian constitutional referendum, which is going on now for Egyptians in the diaspora and then starts in Egypt in the next few days. Of course, the constitution in Egypt is very contentious, but there's one sort of organization, the Carnegie Endowment, that actually dedicated a significant amount of energy to producing a very detailed comparison between the three constitutions of Egypt that are the source of all of the turmoil. And it's called Comparing Egypt's Constitutions, and it's the 1971 constitution, the 2012 constitution that was written up primarily by the Muslim Brotherhood, and the current draft constitution. And all of this is available, but it really outlines all of the really sort of problematic and polarizing and contested issues vis-a-vis this constitution. What are the pros? What are the cons? And really unpacks it in a way that almost no news organization has done. And I hope it, you know, mainstream media and alternative media pick up on this and really begin to unpack it. But it's sort of hidden in their website, but it's definitely worth a closer look.
And I want to bring in, we're going to spend about 10 minutes talking about Egypt. And I know Sasha and Greg, their project is about poverty and domestic issues. But I just want to get your take, because really, Egyptian uprising, what happened in Egypt in 2011, was momentous. It captured the world's attention. It turned into a model for the protest movements across the world, from Occupy movement in the U.S. to the ones in Greece, Spain, Bahrain. So when you look back, Sasha, I want to ask you this. How curious or how much do you see about what's happening in Egypt right now? Because it really affected so many people around the globe.
Well, I think to me it's one. I'm not an Egypt specialist, and I'm only speaking as an individual consumer of news, not an expert. But it seems to me that we got very fixated on the Arab Springs, on the uprisings, and we viewed them as this almost utopian moment.
Mm-hmm.
And we paid a lot of attention when things were going well. We paid a lot of attention when there was an easy narrative about freedom expanding and so on. And then things got messier and they got uglier and they got rapidly more complicated. And instead of trying to understand the complexities, it seems to me that a lot of the American media are essentially turned away. And so we're getting an abysmally low level of coverage of what's happening in Egypt. And if you think about it, it's extraordinary. It's a country with tens of millions of people in the throes of absolute chaos and absolute repression. And we're not getting anywhere near the level of complex news coverage that we should. When you contrast it with the coverage you get with the BBC, let's say,
mm-hmm.
I think it's particularly stark, because the BBC does a pretty good job of international coverage. CNN, for example, it fixates on a country for a week or two or three. It becomes the flavor of the day. And then all too often, we lose our attention. What worries me about that is we tend to think that if we're not covering it as American journalists, then the story doesn't exist. But of course, the story does exist, and it's impacting a huge number of people. And it's impacting a huge number of people in a very important part of the world. So I think that in ignoring it, we're doing us a big disservice, basically.
What about you, Greg? Because that story got so much attention, it became so big, and we're going to be hearing more and more about it as we approach January 25th, anniversary of that uprising.
Right. Well, and let me just say, too, that for this part of our discussion, I really am an eager listener more than, feeling like I have a special insight to offer. But I will say Sasha's point about how quickly we sort of move on is something I think about with regard to poverty quite a bit. I mean, that's why we started the blog at The Nation 2 years ago, because we felt like it got attention during the census release. And now I'm worried, there are a lot of good articles going on with the War on Poverty anniversary right now, and that I'm worried we'll quickly move on from that. But I personally, in wanting to look at Egypt and talk about Egypt, again, relating it back to poverty here, I've really thought for a while now that the only way we're going to see the kind of significant changes that I've called for in my writing, that Sasha calls for in his book, are with a sustained and visible movement. So I've hoped to take lessons from what's happening over there here.
So, Adel, we have two very, very engaged listeners, Greg and Sasha here. So, before we let you go, just give us really an overview almost 3 years after that historic uprising. Muslim Brotherhood is declared a terrorist organization, even having a picture of Morsi can land you in jail. Journalists have been detained. Three Al Jazeera correspondents are currently in jail. Their detention has been extended. So just give us an overview of what Egypt is faced with. And connecting it to what we are speaking today, one of the main slogans of that revolution was bread and then justice. And none of those two have materialized. So can you just fold economic and political issues that people we're fighting for and struggling for together. And just give us like a brief interview. I mean, brief review of that.
I first want to say that both Sasha and Greg are not exactly eager listeners, but rather very seasoned observers of what's going on.
That's
I
true.
Agree with
Thank
everything
you.
That they said. I think, you know, the problem with the situation is that most of the media coverage of Egypt over the past 3 years, aside from, you know, as Sasha said, in the BBC and some of the more sort of sustained, lengthy engagement with what's going on in Egypt, has presented it as a sort of a David versus Goliath relationship. Protesters are downtrodden, they represent the masses, and then you've got the state apparatus, which is, you know, tyrannical, and that's the way it deals with citizenry. And what we've seen happen over the last 3 years are these sort of ebbs and flows in that sort of dynamic that really sort of obliterate the simplicity, the dichotomies of rich versus poor, religious versus secular, pro-military versus anti-military, Muslim Brotherhood versus, you know, versus non-Islamist. I mean, all of these dynamics are quickly crumbling in a very interesting way, which makes Egypt extremely unpredictable. Today, the margin for political freedom is shrinking for those who have a very strong adversarial relationship to the current roadmap, but it's also expanding quite significantly to anybody who embraces it. The constitution in Egypt is a glass half full, but it's also half empty, this draft constitution, because it enshrines more individual freedoms and criminalizes torture and does a lot of really great things. But on the other hand, it also places the military in a position of absolute power, and they become the final and ultimate arbiter in all state and social affairs. And all of this is happening with significant popular support. So what does this mean as far as the revolution that started on January 25th, 2011? It just means that the revolution was perceived in an overly simplistic way. And because it is a dynamic, living, organic experience, it metamorphosizes. And the media coverage of it needs to be as organic, as engaged, and as prepared to deconstruct its own way of presenting these realities.
It's an unfortunate
moment, but it is also a moment to learn, if you will.
And another issue that's really with respect to Egypt and connected to the topic of our conversation today is poverty rate and hunger in Egypt. Egypt poverty rate has increased to about 26.5% for this year compared to 25% in 2011.
Yes.
So,
You're absolutely right, Malahi. The situation,
and this is the official figure.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, at the end of, as you mentioned, the slogan of the revolution was bread, freedom, social justice. Two of those three are focused entirely on making sure that the impoverished in Egypt have a stake in the future of the country. And consecutive governments, whether it's the military of SCAF during 2011-2012, or Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood, or the current government, none of them have been committed to social justice. They want to see, you know, an increase in foreign direct investment, that Egypt looks good economically according to macroeconomic indicators, that it's, you know, that it just looks good on paper, essentially. Mm-hmm. And very few are reaping the benefits of this revolution, which basically means that Egypt has a fairly long-term, a chaotic situation ahead of it. This is not going to subside immediately. At the same time, you also have governments trying to cut corners, basically offering handouts to the poor to make sure that they go out and vote in this referendum in favor of it, or rushing through infrastructure projects just to make things look good at a momentary period. But none of this is really sustainable. So the problem of poverty is a universal issue, and there are sort of dynamics that are extremely similar between poverty here in the United States and the programs that are in place and doing away with them versus improving them and making them more sustainable and more empowering. And what's happening in Egypt, where you have a state that created essentially a clientelism of poverty, and then effectively pulled out and let, you know, not just the other half die, but basically sort of annihilated the class of the impoverished in Egypt. So it's a very, very distressing situation. But I think eventually the reality is clear as day, and any regime that comes in the future, by ballot box or by coup or by revolution, they have to grapple with the 40% of the population that lives below the international poverty line.
And that's Adel Iskander, Arab media scholar at Georgetown University and the author of Egypt in Flux, Essays on an Unfinished Revolution, as well as the co-editor of Jadalia Izin. And for disclosure, I'm also the other co-editor of Jadalia Izin for the media page. And we're also joined by Greg Kaufman, the former poverty correspondent for The Nation and a contributor to BillMoyers.com. We'll ask him about his new projects, and also Sasha Abramsky, a freelance journalist and senior fellow at the Demos think tank and the author of The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. And we want to invite you to join the conversation. Adel is going to be with us for a few more minutes. So if you have any questions about Egypt, if you want to know what happened to really the most fantastic and iconic uprising in the Arab world in 2011, and also about the American policy, what it is now, it seems to be quite confused. Please do give us a call, 1-866-798-8255, email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or even better, post your comment at yourcallradio.org. So, Adel, before to let you go, where our listeners can go to get an understanding, a good understanding about what's happening in Egypt?
I think, unfortunately, a lot of the media coming out of Egypt in the English language has effectively been sort of strangulated so as to prevent certain information from coming out. But the one sort of platform that I think is quite reliable on Egypt and does a fantastic job doing investigative work and great portraits of lived experience in Egypt is a website called Mada Masr, M-A-D-A, Masr, meaning Egypt in Arabic, and it's a great portal. In addition to that, I think audiences and viewers are best served to basically look at a plethora of different news organizations, because in some instances, news providers are doing a good job on a particular issue in a single momentary period, and then are, as we've said all along, basically drop off, and then some other news organization will pick up. So the best way to really assess what's going on in Egypt and in the Arab world at large is to really sort of expose yourself to the landscape of news content, whether it's BBC, CNN, the alternative news, of course, do a much more nuanced job and are concerned about context and the, sort of the humanistic behind the story. So I would recommend our portal, Jadalia. I think we do as best as we can. We're not a news organization, but we try to offer nuanced and very sort of critical-minded analyses and evaluations of what goes on in the region. But as close as you can get to the source of the news, the more likely that you'll have reliable information that that touches on the nuances.
Thank you so much, Adel, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Adel Iskander is Arab media scholar at Georgetown University and the author of Egypt in Flux, Essays on an Unfinished Revolution, as well as the co-editor of Jadalia Izin. And we are also joined by Sasha Abramsky, a freelance journalist and a senior fellow at the Demos think tank and the author of The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. And Greg Kaufman, the former poverty correspondent for The Nation and a contributor to Bill Moyers. I am Maliha Razazan, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we will be back after this short break.
All of the stories that you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org. That's where you can highlight the reporting that you thought was valuable or make a comment on the program by email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And for more coverage about the war on poverty, stay tuned to a 2-hour Tavis Smiley special on the subject right after your call, beginning at 11 in Place of World. Have your say today here on KALW San Francisco.
For those of you joining us now, I am Malihe Razazan, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We are podcasting our show. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. On Monday, we'll have a conversation about the history of Guantanamo Bay Prison and its future. Saturday is the 12th anniversary of Gitmo, the latest National Defense Authorization Act, which was signed by President Obama last month, lifts transfer restriction on detainees who've been declared to leave and were never charged for a crime. So who's there, who's left, and what its future? And if you have any show ideas for us, please do drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Call us at 1-866-798-TALK. 1-866-798-TALK. Today, it's our media roundtable. We're speaking about coverage of the 50th anniversary of Lyndon B. Johnson's war on poverty. And earlier, we discussed the political situation in Egypt. Today, 50 million Americans live in poverty. So let's start talking about poverty. I just want to we talked about this a little bit before, but I want to go back again and ask you both. Sasha, I want to start with you now. What struck you the most about the way poverty was covered this week because of that occasion?
Well, for me, I thought it was quite interesting that everywhere you turned, you'd see photographs and hear voices of Lyndon Johnson. And this is not one of America's great speakers. It's not Kennedy. It's not Obama. It's not Reagan. You don't tend to think of Lyndon Johnson and think of him for his oratory. But when you actually listen to the State of the Union in 1964, it's an extraordinary speech. And one of the things that struck me was the lack of bombast. When you listen to a lot of modern-day speeches, when you listen to a lot of modern-day State of the Unions, the theatrics outweigh the practicalities. And one of the things that struck me about Johnson's speech is that this was 6 weeks after Kennedy had been assassinated. The entire country was in a state of shock. And Johnson uses the State of the Union to establish this extraordinary quiet dignity. And there's no theatrics, as I said. He just basically gets straight to the point, and he says, we are going to use this moment to basically focus morally on the issue of poverty. And he ends up basically saying that that is one of the ways we can honor Kennedy, that Kennedy had started talking about poverty. He'd started thinking about hunger. He'd started thinking about ways to overcome some of these huge challenges faced by millions of Americans, but he hadn't programmatically formulated it. And Johnson basically runs with that, and he starts developing this extraordinary agenda for change, and it's very holistic. And if you listen to Johnson speak, it's almost philosophical. It's a meditation on what it means to be an American, on what it means to be a healthy society. He talks about housing, he talks about hunger, he talks about health care, but he also talks about transportation. He also talks about the quality of life. He talks about urban environment. And I think that when you look at the breadth of that speech, it's a real eye-opener because, in a sense, it's a high watermark. I don't think any president in the 50 years since has managed to formulate a vision, has managed to formulate a response to poverty that's as quiet and yet as forceful as the one that was formulated in 1964. So for me, that was the sort of educational moment of the week, I think.
And you've written an article about this exact thing on the Nation website, Why We Need a New War on Poverty. The deepening crisis today demands an effort as ambitious as the one launched 50 years ago this week. And you can find this link on our website, yourcallradio.org. What about you, Greg? You have reported on poverty issues for The Nation. For the past two years, you've had your blog and you've been working on this issue for a long time. What do you think the way this momentous occasion, really this historic occasion, was contextualized in the media?
Well, on the positive side, I thought a lot of articles were written that showed the real reductions in poverty that the war on poverty has made. I thought there would be too much that was just saying using the official poverty rate and saying not much has changed. But a lot of articles pointed to the new Columbia University study that shows when you consider all of the programs and some of the costs that aren't costs in, of living that aren't considered in the official poverty measure, that, that we've reduced from 26% to 16% the poverty rate between 1969, Sasha, is that right? In 2012. And so I and they pointed to specific programs that do poverty reduction. That was the good part.
Mm-hmm.
The less good part, as I said before, I think it just continues to be a problem, is it's kind of stunning to me, just the lack of ability to use people who are living in poverty or near poverty as a focal point and getting their voices into these stories to make it the experience of poverty and what people are trying to do to get out of it more authentic for the American public. We need a lot more of that. And then also on the downside to me is I quickly see the mainstream media segueing into Ryan and Rubio
exactly.
and the horse race and how they'll use poverty for whether they'll make 2016 runs and without even much of a critical analysis at all of what they're actually saying. And so it was really a mixed bag for me. I do think the media did a better job than I anticipated looking a little more fairly at what the programs have achieved. But
back in March, when Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism put out the stories of its 2012 stories, it said it indexed stories in 52 major mainstream news outlets from 2007 through the first half of 2012. And as I said in the introduction, it found that really the coverage, it was less than 1%. It was like 0.2% or close to that. And the project director said that in no year did poverty coverage even come close to accounting for as little as 1% of the news whole. And he said it's fair to say that when you look at that particular topic, it's negligible. So what are the reasons for lack of coverage of poverty?
Well, I think one of the things that's happened is that increasingly newspapers from the 1980s on in got rid of their labor beats. Now, obviously, labor and poverty aren't quite the same thing. But what you'd see is you'd see a tremendous emphasis being placed on investing in building up business reporting bureaus. So one news organization after another would beef up their business reporting. But at the same time, they'd scale back or entirely eliminate their coverage of labor as a separate issue, which means you no longer have a generation of reporters who have this expertise on workplace conditions and have this expertise on the living conditions of the working poor and so on. So I think that's one part of it. But I think the other part, in a sense, is a reflection of where the money is, that as the economy has become more unequal, the resources possessed by the bottom 20 to 40% of the economy have gotten smaller and smaller and smaller. So when you say that 1% of news coverage is now devoted to poverty, in a very perverse sense, if your calculus is, well, how much are people worth in society, in a very perverse sense, that makes sense because the bottom 20 to 40% probably only have about 1 or 2 or 3% of the nation's assets. So I think that's one of the things we're seeing, that all of the focus for the last 20, 30 years has gone to people with resources, people with assets. And of course, you know, it makes for a particularly desiccated kind of journalism. It makes for a particularly uninteresting kind of journalism because it means we've lost the ability to tell the stories of millions and millions of families who have really interesting voices and really interesting experiences, but they don't fit into the American economic mainstream at the moment.
That's Sasha Abramsky, freelance journalist and the author of American Way of Poverty. And we are also joined by Greg Kaufman, the former poverty correspondent for The Nation and contributor to BillMoyers.com. So let's talk about what you just said, that who the poor is and not putting face to the figures and numbers and a statistic. Greg, you have worked on this issue for such a long time. Tell us, what does it mean to be poor in America today and how complicated and complex this issue has become because of so many different variables?
Right. Well, first of all, I mean, poverty permeates everywhere now, urban, rural, suburban. It's all races. There are working poor. There are long-term unemployed poor. There are people who can't work. So there is no... Well, there are plenty of stereotypes, but there, you can't say that this is a poor person. I think the lack of understanding of how hard it is to get by on a low-wage job, how hard it is to afford child care, low-income families under the poverty line spend 40% of their income on child care, and that's according to the U.S. Census Bureau figures. I think that was 2010. The complexities of what it's like to the cost of housing, the cost of food, the difficulty to get cash assistance. People don't understand that what welfare reform did to making it hard to get cash assistance and to families going deeper into poverty. In 1996, before welfare reform, for every 100 families in poverty, 68 could get cash assistance. Now that number is down to 25. And so it's not a surprise that from 2000 to now, deep poverty rose from 12.6 million people to 20.5 million people. I think it's like 60% rise. I'm not great at math. But, and it's so complex, and we don't take the time as a media to or our public policy, our policymakers, to explain that to the public so that it makes it easy to keep kicking people as just like not trying hard enough or trying to take advantage of the system. All of these stereotypes, we don't challenge them in a critical way.
Hmm. And I want to ask the same question from you, Sasha, but first let's go and get take one of our callers, Shay in Shelton, who is critical of media coverage of poor. Okay, yes. Good morning.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, please.
Okay,
go ahead.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
In some ways, I feel because of this anniversary, we're all focusing on Lyndon Johnson, and that was in the 60s, and it's like people aren't dealing with now so much. I mean, the corporations don't pay taxes. Oil corporations don't pay taxes. If we got for programs or for the people, you know, one half of 1% of everything, you know, of their growth, would oil companies or every company that makes over $10 million, one half of 1% of what they make a year, and Wall Street does it for their money connections. Every time they make a transaction, there are no taxes. What if we charged, you know, 0.25% for every money connection? Wall Street is very wealthy, and it's like, you know, laws have been made for the affluent, and that's great. Be affluent, but it's like we're going back to almost debtors' prisons, and just leaving the poor in the dirt. Like I mean, the first half of the, you know, I have heard this, that this topic was going to come up on the radio for 2 days. There were ads, and so I've been waiting for like a half hour until the topic actually got.
No, but I think you bring up
Egypt is very important, and what's coming up in the Arab Spring anniversary is very important. But there's going to be all that media about that when it comes up, and poverty gets swept under the rug. Poverty doesn't get dealt with. Poor people are under everybody's shoe.
Yeah, Shay, I just want to mention something that I have to say that at your call, we really have been we care about this issue, and we have covered it on regular basis. After your call, there's going to be a 2-hour Tav Smiley show specifically covering poverty. So I think as far as your call, KLW, goes, we really have paid quite a bit of attention on this issue. So I want to ask you, Sasha, you've talked about this, you've covered this, and that's why I put out this question in terms of what are the other drivers of poverty and hunger in the United States?
Well, I think the driver is actually what Shay's talking about, which is inequality, which is that for the last four decades, everything about our public policy has had the effect of making wealthy people wealthier and poor people poorer. And the income spread between the wealthiest and the poorest has gotten larger and larger almost every year from the early 70s onwards. And at the end point of that, we're now at a point where we have a more unequal society than at any time since 1928. In other words, the America that we're living in the year 2014, it doesn't look like the America our parents, grandparents, or great-grandparents would have grown up in. It looks like the America that the great-great-grandparents generation would have been familiar with. Now, that comes with a price. Because if all the money's flowing upwards, if we're undertaxing the wealthiest individuals, if we have capital gains taxes, that means billionaires are actually paying a lower tax rate than middle-class and working-class Americans, if we have corporate tax loopholes that mean that some of the most profitable companies in the world are paying virtually no taxes, well, of course there's a revenue shortfall. And then one of the things we see is that there is all this talk about, well, we have to balance the budget or we're on the road to fiscal ruin. Well, we do have to balance the budget. We have to find revenues that will cover our basic needs so that we can continue to fund commons. We can continue to fund decent education systems, roads, public support networks, Social Security, and so on. But we can't balance that budget by cutting services to poor people. There's no way you can morally balance the American budget by cutting food stamps for hungry people. There's no way you can morally balance the American budget by cutting early education programs for low-income kids. There's no way you can morally balance that budget by cutting Medicaid services for poor Americans. But these are the things that have been talked about in recent years. And so I do think whenever we're going to have a conversation about poverty in this country, we have to have a conversation about inequality. Because the poverty here is not a poverty of lack of resources. It's not a poverty caused by famine. It's not a poverty caused by natural disaster. The poverty that's going on in America in the year 2014 is a direct relation to the inequality that's going on in America.
So, Craig, because it is so multifaceted, do you think we need to create a different kind of journalism or a field of journalism to really bring all these different components together?
That's a great question. And before I answer that, I wanted to add to Sasha's point. I think when it comes to these budget debates, in addition to being able to make the clear moral argument, I think that Democrats, they're our best bet anyway right now, they need to do a much better job making the economic case. You know, that, for instance, the idea that cutting food stamps is due to the deficit, is going to help the deficit issue. The Congressional Budget Office, before the recent food stamp cuts, had said that food stamps over the next 10 years would only comprise 1.7% of our budget. And I didn't hear anybody ever bring that up. You know, they just cede the field of this, the deficit discussion. Mm-hmm. Same thing, you know, healthcare, Medicaid, preventive care, how much money that saves in the long run. I mean, food stamps, how much more productive people are as adults who received food stamps when they were kids, how much better they learn in school as kids. I mean, we have all of these studies now to make these kinds of arguments. But answering your question about do we need a different kind of journalism, you know, I advise Barbara Ehrenreich's Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Yeah. In fact, I think Rose did a story for that.
Yes, she did.
Yeah, and certainly they are trying to invest, basically pay a good living wage to reporters for their work so that they can spend the time to cultivate the relationships and do the kind of analysis that's needed to really make sense of these issues, because that's not the way, that's not the current journalism model. So I think the short answer is yes, I think we need to do more of that kind of work and investment to reveal what's really happening.
And that's Greg Kaufman, the former poverty correspondent for The Nation and a contributor to BillMoyers.com, and we'll find out where he's going next and what he will be doing next before we end the show. And we also want to hear from you. What do you think about what are you reading and watching on poverty in America? What are your thoughts about media coverage of poverty? What needs to be done to improve the quality and content of reporting on poverty? And you can give us a call, 1-866-798-8255, email feedback at yourcallradio.org, or post your comments at yourcallradio.org. This is a huge subject, and of course, we're not going to be really getting too deep for just spending 57 minutes on this, but let's go to some callers before we continue. William in Belvedere. Good morning, William.
Yes, thank you very much. Mr. Kaufman said something which I think could be misinterpreted. I can't believe he really meant to say that. He said, in describing the difficulties in getting food stamps and other kinds of aid, that the reporters don't report on it because it's so complex. Now, I'd appreciate his comments on that, but let me give you my perspective. If indeed that's what he intended to say, I think it's completely off base. I think the reporters don't report on it because he who pays the piper calls the tune, and our media are owned by more and more centralized conglomerates. So therefore, if you like to keep your job, then you don't report on things in a way that will antagonize those who are making out your paycheck. At least that's my perspective.
Okay. Greg?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure. Well, I'll just take the caller's his characterization of what I said. I'm not sure exactly what I said, but I do agree that, as Sash and I both spoke to, that media outlets aren't encouraging or giving reporters the space to cover poverty in a substantive way. But I'll maintain, and I think Sasha would say this as well, to be a good poverty reporter, to understand the benefits of programs, to understand what people experience trying to access those programs, to understand the complexities of how all of the different factors in their lives are interacting to make their lives harder and make the struggle to get out of poverty harder, is very complex. And I think when reporters don't have the freedom or the time to work with that material and work with people to understand it, when they do try to report on it, they often get it wrong, unfortunately. So that's sort of what I mean about the complexity and needing more time and space to work through it.
And the other thing I realized, doing research for this hour's show, was that you see a lot of figures, you see a lot of official and basically expanded statistics about poverty, about hunger in America. But when journalists talk to, want to get sort of confirmation or affirmation of what they're doing, they really talk to think tanks and they talk to academics. I have never seen or hardly seen anyone from any non-governmental organization, grassroots organization, an activist being quoted. And actually, some readers complained to New York Times exactly because they don't get any traction.
Right. I think it partly depends on who the journalist is. I mean, there are plenty of good journalists at newspapers like the New York Times who have huge source lists and know exactly who to go to if they want to understand homelessness, let's say, or they want to understand drug addiction or many of the problems that the New York Times does cover. So I wouldn't want to demonize large newspapers like the Times. I do think that they have the capacity to cover stories well, and I do think that at times they go to the grassroots and they get very interesting, very good quotes. But I do think there's a systemic problem, which is that we tend to think of these issues individually. So we tend to have reporters out there who know an awful lot about, let's say, Medicaid. And we have other reporters who know an awful lot about maybe housing policy. And we have other reporters who are doing quite good work on criminal justice. But we don't have reporters who put it all together. And I think that comes back to what I was saying earlier, that we don't have labor beats. We don't have poverty beats. Now, the thing about poverty is when you talk to people, you find that usually it's more than one thing that comes together to put that person into poverty. that it's usually a combination of low wages or unemployment combined with high housing costs, combined with inability to get affordable health care, combined with a set of other problems. And all of those cumulatively become unmanageable. Now, I think if you think of them as individual isolated problems, in a sense, you miss the complexity. And this comes back again to what we were talking about earlier. Poverty is an extraordinarily complicated story in a country as wealthy as America. It's about absolute poverty, but it's also about relative poverty. It's about the economic calculus, but it's also about the psychological calculus. What does it feel like to be excluded from social consumption rituals? Now, when you speak to people, when you go around the country and you talk to people in poverty, oftentimes it's the psychology they'll spend at least as much time talking about as the actual economics. But if you don't have resources devoted to developing that poverty beat, if you don't have journalists who are spending years and years and years learning about it, it's not that there's a conspiracy of silence. It's just that you don't end up with the expertise. You don't end up with people in those bureaus capable of putting it all together and saying, well, this is a problem that is so complicated that we have to approach all these different issues. We have to bring in healthcare. We have to bring in housing. Mm. We have to bring in all of these things. And unless you do, you tell a partial story.
And before we are actually coming up to closing time, but I just want to ask you, Greg, you have left your regular job, if I may so say so, at The Nation, yeah. And you're going to spend more of your time focusing on activism and working with grassroots organizations who are doing poverty work on the ground. Why did you make that decision?
Well, let me say quickly, I still am contributing to the
NationBillMorris.com,
but you're right, not weekly. And I made the decision because the more I kept writing this article, these articles trying to sort of fuse policy and people's experiences, people in poverty's experiences, the more I just kept writing, the end would be, and we're not going to see these kinds of changes without a big, a substantial movement that's ongoing and visible. And I just kept getting frustrated not being a part of trying to build that. And in fact, I'd been pitching ideas to different
groups. Sorry to have to cut you off. We are coming to the end. We will continue this conversation and we will have you back on the show. We are going to leave it here. We've been speaking with Sasha Abramsky, freelance journalist and author of The American Way of Poverty. Greg Goffman, the former poverty correspondent for The Nation, will put links to resources at our website, yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for your call, emails. Sorry we could not get to all of you. I am Malihe Razazan, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. She'll be back on Monday, and this is Your Call. Have a good weekend. On the next Your Call, we'll mark the 12th anniversary of the U.S. military detention camp at Guantanamo Bay by discussing its legacy. The latest National Defense Authorization Act lifts transfer restrictions on detainees who were never charged with a crime. Who is being held at Guantanamo Bay prison today? And what are the experiences of prisoners inside that facility? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.